And our tech correspondent today is Mark Pesce. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Catherine.
A bit of a development. I hope you're well, by the way, as well as anyone else in
very
situation.
Well. Thank you for asking.
That's good. That's good to hear. Look, yesterday we had a bit of an item with Daniel Ayres, the New Zealand security expert, on questioning why the cabinet had been using Zoom. That was certainly revealed a little earlier. I'd be interested to see if things have changed. We might ask further questions today of the Prime Minister, perhaps. Other media have also reported a little bit more fully today and have sought comment from the likes of the GCSB. But just update us on what's been learned out of overnight from more than one international media outlet. The Intercept was cited yesterday. I think Wired has written on this as well, about the questions around Zoom and security for very high-level video conferencing like cabinet meetings.
So these are really good questions to be asking now, because we've basically gone from zero to one with everyone using Zoom. Now, what Zoom says and what The Intercept talked about yesterday, Zoom claims that they do end-to-end encryption, which means if you and I were doing a video call, at no point anywhere between the two of us would anyone be able to see what we were doing, what we were talking about. In point of fact, that's not what Zoom is doing. Zoom is doing transport encryption. Now, to break that down, that's essentially what you do when you're having a conversation with your bank over the web. When you see that little lock symbol appear in your browser, it means that no one can peek in, but the bank can see what you're doing and you can see what you're doing. Now, the thing about this is that Zoom is sitting in the middle. So you are sending your video to Zoom and no one can see it in the middle. Zoom, however, can see it, and then they re-encrypt it and send it off to the people that it's going to. And what we don't know, even though Zoom says as their terms of service that they would never look at your video or never use your video, when you see important, confidential, secret, actually strategic information being sent over these, you have a point in the middle when anyone, any state actor, any court via subpoena, any hacker could get in and actually see those videos, because they're coming through a single point that can be tapped.
We're just looking also, I'm just looking at New Zealand Herald's reporting today on what Daniel Ayres had to say. Its terms and conditions, until it changed just days ago, allowed it to keep chat messages and files exchanged in meetings. And a recent regulatory filing revealed that it had some 700 staff employed at research and development centres in China. And just raising some pretty obvious questions, really, about the level of scrutiny on a company and on a platform that is being used by governments, not just here, but the UK as well. They seem to be, and the Prime Minister made this clear, up to a certain level, the sort of security level, they are discussing matters, and above that, not.
Yeah.
But still, the questions are fair, aren't they?
They're absolutely fair. And anytime we use a technology, particularly if it's being used for government, we have to ask a whole set of questions about the duty of care of the data that's being transmitted over that technology. And the thing about Zoom is it's very easy to use. A lot of people are using it for a lot of situations. And in those cases, it's more or less innocuous. I would probably not share secrets you would be afraid to divulge more openly over Zoom right now. I think that probably the telephone is still relatively the most secure way to do that. So I would caution people just to be a little bit paranoid around that because of this man in the middle. And if that man in the middle is China or is workers in China who have access to all of this data because that data is freely available because they're working for Zoom or some other state actor, I mean, keeping in the U.S. is part of the Five Eyes, which means New Zealand and Australia and the UK and Canada can probably all tap into that data as well. So there is a real question. The news last night that Boris Johnson was doing a cabinet meeting on Zoom and the whole cabinet was there, I just winced because I'm thinking these people haven't actually tested that technology.
Let's just carry on for a moment. You mentioned earlier vulnerabilities. This is, again, using the Herald's report of Daniel Ayres, who's carried on talking about this clearly since our chat yesterday. He points out that overnight, so between yesterday and today, two new zero-day vulnerabilities were revealed in Zoom. Wired and other US media say the flaws could give an attacker control over a victim's microphone and camera.
Well, and worse than that, they could also give control over the victim's network. There is another vulnerability that was found that if you're using this on a Windows machine, they can basically send a very simple message that then unlocks the network. So you get all the files on the network. So not just the camera and the microphone, which are bad enough, but all of the files on what might have been to that point a secured network. And, you know, can we blame Zoom for this? Well, again, these companies tend to practice security by obscurity. In other words, they tell you and they hand wave about what they're doing, but they don't open it up for an inspection. And where you have a program like Signal, which is the app that I use when I'm talking to people, that one is open. The source is open so that cryptographers, people who are experts in security, can go in and poke at it. And if you can't poke at an app, you can never really trust it. And you're going to see all of these. And I'm sure these are not the last vulnerabilities in Zoom that we'll see.
The difference is the risks that people are taking to use it for, you know, quite low-level conversations and the convenience. I know its growth is zooming ahead at the moment, pardon the pun, absolutely zooming ahead. But when you are talking about some of our most senior and confidential conversations, one wonders, even with, you know, up to the level of restricted, it's been guaranteed up to the level of restricted, the Prime Minister said. So we keep in mind what we're discussing on the call. There are certain agenda items we just will not discuss on Zoom. I think the GCSB also did give a statement to the Herald. I'll read that if you wouldn't mind. The Bureau is aware of commentary overnight relating to the security of the Zoom platform and will consider if additional guidance around its use is required. Mm-hmm. And also, the GCSB has provided advice to government about security considerations when working remotely during the COVID-19 Level 4 response. This includes information security advice and advice on encrypted messaging and conferencing platforms, including Zoom. We are working on a security guide for government users that distributed more widely. And it seems to boil down to consider what it is that you're talking about. Are there alternatives? And again, is this in this extraordinary and fast-moving situation, many of us are scrambling to get the sort of systems in place that we need to work remotely, all the way up to government, all the way up to cabinet. But is there an obvious alternative to going to a public company like this or a private company like this and then learning more as days go by about your level of security?
You know, if it's just a two-person video conference, then I would suggest people use Signal, which is an app that's available for all of the platforms. And again, that source code is open. It gets tested by professionals. And so it's basically best in class. Now, theoretically, as much as I dislike endorsing any Facebook product, WhatsApp, which a lot of people use, uses exactly the same code base as Signal. And so theoretically, WhatsApp has the same level of security. But again, it's a Facebook product. I don't like Facebook. I don't think people should use it. But a lot of people use WhatsApp, and so they can be reasonably assured. And then as you go out beyond that, there's less and less clarity because all of these companies have their own solutions, and they say they work great and they're secure, and you have no proof.
Just another point. Again, if you're just on an app or a video conferencing system for far less serious matters of national security, I suppose the other general thing to be aware of is that with this explosion that's happening, you know the hackers are on the look as well. And I know a lot of people have signed up to some very popular apps of late. You don't want to sort of ruin the fun or ruin the really important connection that they're providing. But again, it's just to be aware of your security, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, again, most of us, because we do this in an office, don't really have to think other than there's conversations you might have privately and conversations that you'd have publicly. And we need to sort of, I guess, bring that thinking now into our practice at work from home. What are the conversations we're having privately? We'll use a slightly more private channel. Now, a lot of folks aren't necessarily getting guidance from their IT staffs who are now just busy trying to support everyone in work from home around the right things to do. So it's good to hear that the government is actually thinking about putting out some guidelines. I think there needs to be a lot more of that, because that's then going to get the IT organizations in businesses to come along and go, yes, here's the different grades of security that the different tools offer you. Make your decisions wisely.
Also, on very much on the agenda in COVID is the use of technology to trace. And I know there's some in use, quite extreme stuff in use already. That's probably been successful in some countries in dealing with a pandemic, but has been a real invasion of privacy. I'm thinking of in Hong Kong, I think it could almost track you around your apartment. And I know there are many companies, including here, who are looking and developing products they believe could be useful for tracing. What's the real sort of rubbing up that's coming at the moment between the efficacy of the tracing tools and the privacy incursion?
Yeah, so there was a beautiful video that was released on Twitter last week that showed how much tracking data people are getting from their mobile phones. And it actually went and zoomed into a beach for spring break in Florida in Fort Lauderdale and showed where all these kids were partying and they shouldn't have been because they were infecting one another. It showed that they could track those devices to when they went back home all across the East Coast and Midwest, which are now real hotspots of infection in the United States. And it was amazing that we could do that kind of tracking. It was also terrifying that we could actually do this really sort of granular tracking. And they say, well, the location data is anonymized, except location is the one thing that's not anonymous about you. You are a body in space. You have a location. People can figure out who you are pretty easily by where you're hanging out. And so this idea that we're just going to, oh, it's all anonymous, we're just looking at the flow, is really hiding the fact that, in fact, these technologies have been revealed now. We always suspected they could do this, but now in the name of public health, they're being fully revealed as very intense technologies of surveillance. And there's going to be a lot of, I think, really, really important public debate about when does public health outweigh private privacy. And that's a good debate to be having. We should never just go one way or another, but every step along the way, understand how we will be able to roll things back, because the epidemic will end and we will want to get our privacy back. And if we have put all this stuff into place, will we be able to pry it off, or will it be like a barnacle basically welded onto us?
It's a really important question. There've been some other extreme examples you found.
So there are bosses who are installing spyware on their employees' computers to make sure they're truly working from home. And, you know, this is, it's not just bad because it indicates a lack of confidence in the part of the boss and perhaps some insecurity, but almost any piece of spyware that a boss installs is going to be able to be suborned by a hacker. So the hacker has another way in to attack your business or to read confidential files. And this, again, is that line where, you know, if you're an insecure boss and was always keeping an eye on your employees in the office, that is going to be so much worse when everyone is working from home. And if you think technology is going to fix this, no, it's really in the end only going to make you less secure.
Yeah, that sort of panic buy. It's amazing what people panic buy. And there you go. Some bosses think that's the top priority. And as you've pointed out, I think, or another thing, there's some good sides to this. There's a global movement underway to crowdsource techniques to repair medical equipment.
Yeah, so these are the folks from iFixit. And if you've ever seen a teardown video when they take a new piece of technology and tear it apart to show you what's inside, these are the folks who do that. So they're quite well respected and they sell a lot of repair tools. But what they've realized is that there's a lot of medical equipment that will need repairs. New York got a whole bunch of ventilators that were broken and they needed very quick repairs on them. So what they're doing is they're asking people all around the world to crowdsource everything they know about how to repair all this medical equipment that's going to be in very high demand over the next couple of months. So that if anything breaks, we will be able to find some very easy to use resource to get someone to fix that piece very quickly. And this means that we'll be able to build more equipment, be able to repair the existing equipment we have, and meet the needs of the people who will need that equipment.
And any other good news you've spotted in all this in the tech zone?
There is a wonderful website called helpwithcovid.com. It is a place where if you're technically inclined and you want to participate, you'll be able to find all of the projects that are open, what their needs are. And the needs are very broad. Some of them are technology, some of them biology, some of them medicine. But it's a place for people to coordinate, because there's a lot of people who, like us, are sitting at home right now but might not have enough to do or might want to get involved. And helpwithcovid.com is becoming a central point to be able to coordinate those efforts. And so even though we're all working from home, we don't need to feel alone. We can actually be part of a bigger effort to help.
The other thing is the psychology of that, Mark, isn't it? That what's really doing everyone over this one, apart from the immediate consequences so many people are facing, is the uncertainty of where it all goes and when. And that wreaks havoc with the human psyche and the way it's set up. So anything that gives you a sense of control, or that you're contributing to making a difference and getting through this thing, is going to be a very nice, happy moment in your brain.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's the thing that's going to get people out of bed in the morning. It's not only will we see the end of this, but we will do it together.
Thank you so much. Mark Pesce is our tech commentator today.